This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, we have a couple of our Friday favorites. Matt O'Lean reviews the new Tenet film, which is described as James Bond on acid. And we have news director Dave Thompson looking back at this week's biggest stories. But first, it is our fall member drive, the first day of our fall member drive. We are going to start out today's member drive with another one of our favorites, the Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy. Jack Russell Weinstein joins me now. He is the host of Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which airs this coming Sunday at 5 o'clock Central. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
It's the radio. You can't see me blush, Ashley.
Well, the Why Show has been on, how long has this been on the air? I know you've done more than 100 episodes.
This month starts our 13th season.
Wow.
The math is a little wonky, right? I think it's like 11 years, but it's our 13th season, and I think it's 140th episode.
Oh, that's incredible. Why did you pick Prairie Public for a home for a show like that?
Well, actually, Prairie Public sort of picked me. I talked to Bill very early on about this show idea that I had, and he said, great, you know, let's do 3 episodes and see how it works, and then we'll talk. And he just never told me to stop.
That must have been so hard for you not to be told to be quiet.
I'm not used to that at all. Usually I have to fight my way through the crowd.
Well, you are supporting a show like Why and a show like Main Street, or whatever your reason for tuning in to Prairie Public. You can make your investment now with a simple phone call, 800-359-4145, or you can click and join at prairiepublic.org. It just takes a couple of minutes, but it makes all of the difference here. And instead of airing those commercials, we get to air a show like Why, because Why is a show that needs a lot of room to breathe. Because, Jack, every month this kind of astounds me. Like, you had a show, I remember, What is Literacy? And my mind was like, the ability to read. And now what are you going to do for the next 60 minutes on air, or 90 minutes if you're listening to the podcast? But it was a fascinating, nuanced conversation that just wouldn't have happened, in my opinion, with those commercial breaks in there. So you are someone, if you are going to make a contribution right now, you are somebody who wants to devote an entire hour of listening to the nuances that come up when only a philosopher tackles a subject like literacy. 800-359-4145 or prairiepublic.org.
This is precisely why public radio is so important, because I get to share my curiosity with other folks. I get to really explore the ideas, not in these 2-minute, 3-minute sound bites that reduce everything to a factoid, but really the process of exploring alongside the listeners and the process of expanding where we can get beyond political battles or what's immediately in front of our face and say, hey, let's take something that we're interested in and pull all of the different threads.
Yes.
You're not going to get that on anything other than public radio. And frankly, the North Dakota public radio system, Prairie Public, is particularly good at this because we have an expansive state. We have a state based on, you know, panoramic views.
Yes.
And philosophy is a panoramic view. Where would it be more appropriate than having this discussion on Prairie Public?
Oh, I love that. You get to this panorama visually and mentally. It becomes a multidimensional experience. And maybe, you know, especially because you can listen on your smartphone or whatever, you can be sitting outside and taking in that panorama view and that expansive sky and getting your mind expanded with a show like Why. Support that now when you call 800-359-4145 or when you click and join at prairiepublic.org. Jack, this month's episode of Why is airing this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central. And the topic is hatred.
This is a perfect example of what I was saying before, actually. You start thinking about hatred and you're limited to this notion that it's bad, right? We shouldn't do it. Let's hide the hate in our hearts, right? Our whole culture is this sort of dual personality of we have media that exploits our hatred, that sells advertisement based on our hatred, that even, you know, creates television shows, entire series based on our hatred. But then they tell us that hate is bad, that we shouldn't communicate it, and that we shouldn't dwell on it. And as a philosopher, I get to ask if that's the whole story. And my guest really allows us to open up the full spectrum, including starting with the hypothesis that sometimes hate may be useful and good.
So who is your guest?
My guest is a philosopher named Berit Brogard out of the University of Miami, and she's written a bunch of different books that touch upon the relationship between philosophy and cognitive science. So there's not just some discussion of brains, but also just some conversations about how emotions work and how they relate to our rational minds. And so what she has done in her actually upcoming book, it hasn't been published yet. I had to read the galleys rather than the physical book. What she's done is shown this connection between hatred and a whole range of other emotions and psychological disorders, because it turns out that people with psychological disorders like narcissism are more prone to hate than other folks. So what's the connection and what are the moral consequences as well as the legal and interpersonal consequences of that?
And before I even asked who the guest is, you said something very intriguing, that there are times when hatred might be good. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe if I'm super competitive and I'm like, I hate losing and that fuels me to try to win. I don't know. Is that a little too base instinct?
We can talk about hatred as a spectrum. And so we can use hatred as a metaphor for other emotions like the desire to win, the desire to dominate, and not necessarily a bad sense, right? but there are times when hatred is healthy, right? Mm. If you are the victim of a crime, or if your relationship has become abusive or unsettling, that hate can help you heal. Right, in the way that anger can help you here, it shouldn't be a permanent state. It shouldn't become pathological. But hate helps us communicate that the person that we are looking at, the person that we are interacting with, is not just doing something bad, but is holistically acting in a way that is dehumanizing to others, that is demoralizing to others, and that really undermines the very essence of who we are. In that instance, hate can be very appropriate.
I mean, it sounds like one of the stages of grief that you just have to pass through.
You know, I think that that's probably true, again, in certain more extreme situations. It would be nice if we lived in a world without hate. But on the other hand, it would be nicer if we lived in a world without hateful things, right? We live in a world where bad things happen. We live in a world where people do horrible things. And to react as if they don't exist and to react as if there's no emotional response to that makes us into robots, not human beings. I mean, how could you look at the events of the last 6 months at this country and not, on one side or another, feel hate towards the violence, the victimization, the destruction of the security of our lives, right? I mean, hate is a legitimate response here. However, there's a difference between, as Britt argues, personal hate and group hate. Hating a person makes sense as long as you don't want revenge, as long as you yourself don't dehumanize. But when you hate a group, you're generalizing in a way that doesn't describe people's individual experience. So one of the really interesting aspects of our conversation is that she wants to distinguish what seems actually sometimes counterintuitive, that when hate is acceptable, it is aimed at an individual person because it's aimed at their own actions and their own ways of being.
Sure.
But it's never aimed at a group, because when you're aiming at a group, you're accusing people or acting individuals of doing something that they might not be doing.
So it's not based on personal experience at all when it's the group.
That's right. Let's say you hate all red-haired people. Well, that's nonsense,
I'm
right?
Jealous
because there's
of
some
them.
More. Right? Yeah, well, that's a whole different conversation. But, you know,
it's so pretty.
Maybe there are some evil redheads out there, but that doesn't mean that all redheads are evil, right? And so you can even, and she made a point, and this is, you know, again, counterintuitive, but really interesting. She said, even hating all of the German Nazis doesn't make sense, right? Arthur Schindler was a Nazi, right? He was officially a member of the Nazi Party, and yet rescued tremendous amounts of Jews that were all very familiar with it. It turns out some information came out that Hering Goring's brother helped help Jews escape from the Nazi clutches. And so even the phrase like, I hate Nazis, right? Indiana Jones in the third movie looks at Nazis and goes, ah, Nazis, I hate those guys, right? You know, even that generalizes from a particular, is based on a logical fallacy that falls apart if you look at individual things. Now, if you say, I hate genocide, if you say, I hate people who participate in genocide, that's a different situation. And so hate becomes justified when it's focused on an individual because we know that the individual is worthy of the attention of our emotion. It's not an assumption about them that isn't necessarily true.
Fascinating. How much of group hate could also be more accurately defined as fear?
Certainly, fear plays a very big role in all of these things. And ignorance plays a role as well. The problem is that if we reduce hate to just those things, then what we end up saying is hate is useless and we should deal with the fear. Instead of saying hate is, you know, this many parts fear, this many parts ignorance, this many parts experience. And then we say, okay, we have this emotion. Let's use it while it's useful, and then let's heal from it while it's not.
Do the two of you arrive at a definition of pure hatred?
We don't come up with a strict definition. What we end up doing is talking about a spectrum of justifiable hate. And I think that that's really useful because philosophy tends to want to define things in very precise ways. And for technical writing and technical exploration, that can be useful. Mm-hmm. But for the day-to-day life, if you feel hatred towards someone, are you going to go back to this definition and say, well, I don't think this qualifies as a clear definition of hate, so I can go on acting this way? No, you're going to say, look, I feel elements of hate. I have to ask if it's justified. I feel elements of anger. I have to act like it's justified. And one of the examples that she gives of unjustified hate is really interesting. She says, let's say you hate someone, but you see them lying in the street about to get hit by a car. No matter how much you hate them, you can't not pull them away. If you refuse to help someone in need, even though you hate them, you are not acting morally. Why? Because it diminishes their personhood. You have to help people who are in need, even if you hate them. And that's the difference between justifiable and unjustifiable hate, because unjustifiable hate causes other people harm as opposed to allowing you to feel the spectrum of your emotions and morally evaluate the situation involved.
So it's the classic philosopher, you know, sort of trolley thing. Well, not exactly the trolley problem, but
I am not a fan of the trolley problem. and I'll actually tell you why. The problem with the trolley problem is that it's a scenario that shouldn't have happened in the first place. It's easy for us to say, oh, someone's on track A, someone's on track B, who do you save? But the harder question is, how did those people get on the tracks in the first place, right? Let's look at the Black Lives Matter stuff, and let's look at what happened to George Floyd. Mm-hmm. We have this conversation, right? Who was right? Who was wrong? Should the officer have put his knee on his neck? Should the other officers have helped? But what's super complex is how we got in a situation where a police officer could be in that situation, where George Floyd could be in that situation, where we have bad neighborhoods, where we have an underclass based on race. These are where the hard questions come in. And the trolley question takes us away from that. Again, think about this in terms of hate. You ask, should you hate or shouldn't you hate? And that's an important question. But an even more important question is, how did the situation arise where someone did possibly hateful things in the first place? Mm. What went wrong that we can justifiably hate someone or something, and maybe that state shouldn't have existed in the first place?
Well, I think that's a very human thing to do, is to oversimplify, in part just because we are overwhelmed with the amount of information that we need to process, sometimes literally just to stay alive. And so to oversimplify just makes it possible for our lives to go forward. But of course, then you don't get that nuance. You don't get the understanding and the context that really underscores the heart of any issue, especially something that has potential for grave consequences like group hatred. And a show like Why allows us to explore that in hopes that that doesn't happen. So when you are supporting Prairie Public and a show like Why, you are advancing conversation and understanding.
Why Radio is listener supported in every single way. It's supported by the donations that people make. And that's, you know, we couldn't do it without that. We're entirely listener supported at every level. But at the same time, it's listener supported because the people who listen have to give themselves. They have to participate in the conversation. Our listeners aren't passive listeners.
No.
They're active listeners, right? They think up questions. They send me emails and texts and things like that. They're involved in the conversation. They anticipate the conversation as it goes. That's actually the most fun aspect of my job, is advocating for the listenership, is having the conversation and asking myself, what question would the listener ask if he or she were in the room, and if they were used to philosophy enough to ask the questions quickly, right? That's the skill I bring in. I don't think that I ask questions that someone isn't going to come up with. I think I ask questions that someone is going to come up with quicker than they do, because it's, you know, it's a party trick that I've learned over several decades of teaching, right? But our listeners are active in every sense of the term. They want to participate in the conversation. They want to talk out loud. They want to re-listen to the podcast. They want to respond on our various different social networks. And they want to give money, because then they are full participants. Everyone who listens gives us the gift of their money and their attention. And in this world, both of those are really spare and very valuable
precious
contributions.
And you can go from being a passive listener to an active member with a simple phone call, 800-359-4145, or you can click and join at prairiepublic.org. We're visiting today with Professor Jack Russell Weinstein. He is the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. This month's episode airs Sunday at 5 o'clock Central. The theme is hatred, our most dangerous emotion. Jack, how much of hatred is cultural?
I think that that is a really complicated question, but a really important one, because group hatred appears to be very cultural. Right. What groups we decide not to like has to do with our history, has to do with what our parents teach us, has to do with our context. But individual hatred is probably less cultural, because it caters to our more intimate, I don't want to say base instincts, because it's not necessarily negative, right? We all as human beings don't like being abused. We all as human beings don't like being trod upon. We don't like being denied opportunities. Now, of course, what we consider abuse, what we consider disrespect, is cultural. In very traditional religious societies, husbands will treat wives in a way that's very different than in much more progressive open societies, secular societies, or more modern religious societies, right? And so you can imagine a circumstance in which a spouse would feel hate based on something that their partner did, that in another culture would be perfectly normal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think that the hate is necessarily cultural, but the cause of the hate may very much be.
Well, and I feel like, too, I've definitely said to my husband, okay, I love you generally, but I hate you right now, like in this exact moment, or at least I very much hate what just happened.
Well, this is the love-hate relationship is a real indication of both how complicated it is. Yes, that's right. I believe actually you and I had a conversation a while ago where one of us, I will give you credit, described the successful marriage as one in which both partners don't fall out of love at the same time.
Yeah, right? It's true.
And that's absolutely, you know, I don't think the hate we feel for our partners at any given moment is not hate. I think it's real hate, but I don't think it's hate with legs. I don't think it's hate that has any staying power. Mm. You know, think about that gut reaction that you have, but also think about that gut reaction you have when you feel love for someone, yeah. Right? You feel it in your solar plexus. You feel it in the way that your body responds. It's only when you unpack it philosophically, for example, that you can see all of the subtle nuances in the things that we call love, including comfort with someone, faith in someone, the pleasure of touching or listening or smelling them, the sense of trust you have in someone, the sense of being a part of a joint project and knowing that you have a future in which you are working towards similar goals, right? These are all aspects of love, and they're certainly aspects of mature adult relationship love. Hate has the opposite things, and you can, you know, mature adult relationship hatred can probably be unpacked in that same way.
Well, we would love to hear from you, our listener members. Pick up that phone and call 800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org. Jack, we have about a minute left here. What is the philosopher's argument for paying for a service that you can tune into for free?
The argument is taking individual responsibility for the world that we live in, right? It isn't just that Prairie Public needs it, although it does. And it isn't just having to contribute to a society that you build. It's about the fact that we create the world that we live in, and we have to contribute to the world that we want to make it happen at all levels, metaphysical, on our individual actions, and in terms of economics. You have to contribute because you are the author of the world as well.
Jack Russell Weinstein is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and he is the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which airs monthly right here on Prairie Public. This coming episode is Sunday at 5 o'clock Central as Jack and his guest explore hatred, our most dangerous emotion. Jack, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you, Ashley.
Still to come on Main Street, we have our discussion about the news with Dave Thompson. But now it's time for today's headlines.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Some members of the Burley-Morton COVID-19 task force are raising questions about a public messaging piece the task force will be undertaking. The task force has hired a Bismarck and ad agency to do the messaging, which will involve social media and traditional media. This comes after two local government boards turned down mask mandates. Maxine Hare is the public information officer for Morton County. She told the task force she wonders whether it's worth spending the money at the local level or at the state level on trying to get people to wear masks voluntarily when it appears that may not work. Hare suggested that more emphasis be put on people's overall health, since most of the COVID-19 related deaths are among people with underlying health conditions.
Why do we commend the person wearing a mask in the grocery store but don't flinch when they fill their cart with Little Debbie snacks and sodas? How about instead of handing out masks at the entrance, we hand out vitamin D? How about we incentivize healthy behaviors instead of COVID death counts? The CDC says that those at higher risk of severe illness from COVID include obesity, in which North Dakota ranks 8th in the nation, which can lead to diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and some types of cancer, all of which are also common underlying conditions for COVID deaths.
Marvin Lean is with Mid-Dakota Clinic. He told the task force the CDC has told providers the easiest way to spread the virus is through spreading droplets by coughing or sneezing.
Preventing someone from having to enter into respiratory care needs, and if I could be so bold as to say, to the use of a $1.50 mask, is certainly cost-effective.
Lean says his clinics have reported no COVID cases among staff. The task force will meet again in 2 weeks. And 4 more North Dakotans have passed away with COVID-19, bringing the statewide death toll to 164. The patients were a man in his 50s and 2 men in their 80s from Burley County, as well as a woman in her 70s from Mountrail County. They each had underlying health conditions. Additionally, 244 new individuals from 26 counties have also tested positive for the novel coronavirus, bringing the new statewide positive total to 14,684. These results are from a pool of 5,795 tests for a daily positive rate of 4.36%. 65 new cases were found in Grand Forks County, 42 in Cass County, 33 in Burley County. Williams County had 18 new cases, Ward County had 16, and Morton County had 15 cases. Stark County had 6 new cases. Ramsey, Eddy, and Foster counties each had 4. Trail and Rolette counties both had 3 new cases. McKenzie, Sioux, and Walsh counties each had 2. And Adams, Barnes, Dunn, Golden Valley, Hettinger, Mercer, Ransom, Renville, Richland, Sargent, and Wells counties each had 1 new case apiece. There are currently 2,343 active confirmed cases in the state. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and that old wire machine means it's time for our news discussion with News Director Dave Thompson. He joins us on Fridays to talk about the news. And of course, this Friday, it's also the first Friday of our fall membership drive.
Absolutely.
And yes, that means that every contribution is being matched dollar for dollar, thanks to a generous matching fund from a special group of members. So you can get your gift maximized and help fund the radio station that brings you lively conversation every day by calling 800-359-4145 or by going online to prairiepublic.org. Dave, we're always happy to have you on Main Street.
Well, good afternoon, Ashley, and I'm glad to be on Main Street. And hello to you who are listening right now. We're glad you're with us for our Friday recap of the week's news. And to say this has been an eventful news week is probably an understatement. I mean, you look at what's happening nationally, you look at what's happening in the state of North Dakota, the state of Minnesota, there's a lot going on. And we know you appreciate Prairie Public's commitment to bringing you the news and vital information unique to our region. When news happens in North Dakota, you're going to hear about it on Prairie Public, and you can trust that it's going to be accurate and fair. You also appreciate these news roundups on Prairie Public, the weekly chat, our journalist roundtable, when
yes,
we bring in reporters and editors from across the region to weigh in on these stories that are just amazing these days. News, great conversation that is not limited by topic or time. That's what listener-powered public radio can create, and you can help by just calling 800-359-4145 or go online at prairiepublic.org and click the donate button.
800-359-4145 or by going online to prairiepublic.org. Your investment makes everything that you hear possible. And one of our favorite segments, of course, is the ability to look back on the week's news. And yes, it was already presented in well thought out, easy to digest form during the week. But now on Fridays, we can revisit it and have a little bit extra context and analysis.
Right. And some updates as well, too.
Well, right. Because news is changing at, I'm just going to say, unprecedented rates these days.
Speed of light, maybe.
Yeah. Well, especially when it comes to tracking a global pandemic. So the state of North Dakota has at least 3 new deaths and more than 300 new cases.
Yes. And the cases still are rising a bit. And that's that 14-day rolling average of tests and how many tests are positive.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still above 5%, which a lot of people are saying, you know, we need to get that down below 5%. And so just to bring you up to date, there were attempts at the Bismarck City Commission and at the Morton County Commission to go for mask mandates. Both commissions said no, they want it to be more voluntary. Well, that kind of exploded today in the Bismarck, Morton, or Burley-Morton Task Force.
Mm.
And there was a lot of discussion about whether or not you should even be spending money to try to get people to do masks. Maybe your money should be spent on other things, about just overall wellness. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of discussion about that. There's going to be some new messaging rolled around in these two counties about masking and about hygiene and social distancing. Mm-hmm. And that still is very controversial because there were a lot of people on the task force who have, you know, school-aged children, and they're saying the school-aged children are being deprived because of some of the social distancing they have to do. And they're definitely social people. So there was a lot of discussion about that. Can we get some messaging to, you know, reassure them and say, hey, this is a pandemic. Mm-hmm. Eventually it will go away, or we'll have a vaccine or something like that. So there was a lot of talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, it is a fascinating topic that has so many different layers to it. And Dave,
yes, it does.
You said money being spent on messaging, and some people don't like that being spent on messaging. What kind of money are we talking here?
We're not talking about a lot of money, but the state is also spending up to $1.2 million on messaging. The local COVID task force is going to spend a fraction of that. But there is a local ad agency, Agency Mabu, who's working on a plan that's going to be rolled out over the next few weeks, starting with social media and then into traditional media and then eventually into, you know, some follow-up meetings and things like that. They're talking about that. Now there's some real discussion about how there should be kind of a mental health piece on that in terms of messaging that, you know, this might, you know, be possibly injurious to your mental health if you can't deal with it. And I know that there are some issues there, and I know that there has been a lot of discussion about that.
Yeah, we're going to have an interview I recorded yesterday that will air on Main Street on Monday that talks about the behavioral and mental health implications of life during a pandemic.
Right.
And of course, besides our mental and behavioral health, our financial health plays a key role right now in the Emergency Commission approving some new Bank of North Dakota COVID programming for business debt relief. I presume
right.
This is in addition to what's already gone out to businesses earlier this year.
It is, and this one's a little bit different because the debt is existing debt load.
Oh, okay.
And businesses have to go in and say, well, okay, we're having trouble meeting our debt load on this, and they might be able to get up to a $50,000 grant to help ease that debt burden. And what they're doing is they're talking about the first several months of 2020 versus the first several months of 2019 and how things have changed, and maybe that could lead to some kind of relief, at least temporary.
And what's the timeline on this?
Well, they're trying to get maybe things submitted to the bank by probably the end of October so that it can be spent fairly quickly because, you know, this is all part of that, you know, COVID federal relief plan,
mm-hmm.
the CARES Act.
Right.
And that has deadlines of the end of the year. So there's some urgency to this.
Okay. Any specific businesses that they really want to gear towards?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because a lot of businesses that probably need the help right now could be the businesses like hotels, motels, bars, restaurants, which were really impacted when, you know, the social distancing rules were put in place. They had to first off, you know, shut down and just do takeout only, and then they had to have reduced capacity. And we're getting capacity back up, but for a while there, they were really kind of hurting. And there are other programs, of course, to help businesses out, you know, to do touchless faucets, touchless toilets, that type of thing, to limit the amount of personal touch and the spread that way.
And those are all very expensive upgrades.
They are.
In non-COVID news, there is an IT unification study, and it looks like there are some positives, some challenges out of this.
That's correct. And this was proposed by the Burgum administration now almost 2 years ago.
Okay.
That was in the session. The legislators did not want to go all the way at this point, so they had some agencies say, okay, we can agree to do this. But so far, there seems to be working out. What the problem is that the agencies that have separate elected officials are balking about doing this because they have different protocols, different computer systems, that type of thing. And I think that's going to have to evolve over probably several more years.
Yeah, I read that some agencies talking about those specialized IT needs, like the Land Department. I'm wondering, can you kind of give us just a brief overview of what that would mean? What would be their specialized IT needs?
Well, Land Department deals with basically leases, oil leases. And a lot of that money goes from, you know, the leasing into the Common Schools Trust Fund. And so there's been concern about that. There's also a concern that the agency had for a while, I'm talking about the Land Department, had possibly been undercharging some of the oil companies for the leases. Now there are efforts to collect it, but they've stalled because right now oil is not doing very well price-wise, and there's been some slowdown in the Bakken.
We have a cute story here that you got to do on paleontology being taught online. Nice adaptation to the Zoom atmosphere.
That was fun. I really enjoyed that. I didn't think about that, but when, you know, classes went online, some of the paleontologists said, well, we can deliver some stuff via Zoom or via platforms. So they took some of the fossils with them. They went into their offices and started, you know, recording lectures. And then just a few days after that happened, well, they shut the Heritage Center down where the paleontologists work. Mm. And so they had to take some of these artifacts home and work through online platforms. And then they determined that they could actually put more scope to it. And they got some very knowledgeable national folks to have some lectures online that are accessible, you know, at any time on YouTube platforms or other platforms like Zoom or Microsoft Teams or something like that. And it's helping the students out because they're able to learn things about paleontology, which is, as you might know, you know, dinosaurs is pretty big right now. So there's a lot of demand for that.
Well, this pandemic has certainly closed doors and opened others. It is at times a troubling and at times a fascinating time to be alive. And no matter which experience you are having at any given moment, you can rely on Prairie Public to have a story that will deepen your understanding. And you are supporting that now when you call 1-800-359-4145 or when you click and join at prairiepublic.org. Contributions today being doubled with that member matching fund, 800-359-4145 or prairiepublic.org. We still have Madeline after this. Dave, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Ashley.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, there's the fanfare. That means it's time for another movie review with Matt Olean. Matt, I watched the trailer for this, and it looks pretty action-oriented. Tenet?
Yes, Tenet, directed by Christopher Nolan of Inception, Memento, Interstellar, Dunkirk fame. He likes one-word titles.
Right.
He also likes time travel. He's quite obsessed with time travel and alternate universes, and I'll get to that in a moment. This was the film that Nolan resisted throughout COVID to stream it. A lot of other people went streaming. Yep, I'm going to put my film on Netflix or Prime.
Oh.
He says this has to be seen on the big screen. So
the reviews,
waited. And he,
yeah, one of the reviews said, see on the biggest screen possible.
And it does need to be seen on the big screen. So he waited and waited and waited and finally chose Labor Day weekend. And it made $20 million. That, in a normal year, on a Labor Day weekend, I think a Chris Nolan film probably does 75, 80 million.
Yeah.
So you have to say, you know, again, seven people in the theater when I went, limited seating. So 20 million is probably a pretty good weekend. I think they have to be pretty satisfied with that, considering some hot spots going on in the nation and things like that. As for the film, this plot was under top secret for months. People couldn't get a sense of what the film was about. Nolan was very secretive of it. Basically, it's a James Bond film meets time travel. That's essentially what it is.
Yeah.
There's a plot about plutonium. There's always like plutonium or nuclear weapons, right, in a Bond film.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's also this time travel situation with bullets that can come backwards. And there's a lot of really interesting things that have to do with that. And essentially, John David Washington from BlacKkKlansman fame and Robert Pattinson, who plays British intelligence in this, they kind of team up to try to find the guy who is doing this strange time travel situation, which involves going into the future and then knowing what people are going to do because you've seen the future and then affecting the past. And it's very complicated.
Yeah.
The first scene in the film is incredibly hard to follow. It's a big assault at an opera house in the Ukraine. The final scene of the movie is really hard to follow. It's so difficult to tell who's in forward time, who's in backward time. And I think Nolan gets a little obsessed with it throughout the film. In fact, his obsession with time travel is wearing a little thin on me with Interstellar and Inception and things like that and parallel universes. And I think basically it's an espionage film with Chris Nolan's obsession with time travel. Now, parts of it work. There's some great set pieces. There is a chase scene on a highway that is just phenomenal. I mean, it is French Connection, Bullet, that kind of great kind of chase scene, especially when you have cars moving backwards and forwards depending on which part of this time travel our hero is in. Kenneth Branagh plays the Russian arms dealer. There's always a bad Russian, right, in a Bond film or an espionage. Branagh does a great Russian accent. Elizabeth Debicki, very nice performance as his kind of kept wife who cannot stand him. But there's reasons that she can't leave him. And, of course, our espionage folks are trying to help her. So that's essentially the plot. A lot of great set pieces. But, again, with a lot of Nolan films, the sound design is maddening. He loves to have the music on full bore during some scenes where there's talking. And I would say one-third of the dialogue in this film is incomprehensible. I could not understand it. Now, when things are quiet, when it's just like a dinner party scene with Branagh and John David Washington, you can hear what they're saying. But too many times, and I know Nolan likes to do this, the sound design is so heavy that it's hard to hear the dialogue. So I left the theater slightly disappointed. I wanted to like this film a lot more than I did. Look, the production values are off the charts. Washington and Robert Pattinson have great chemistry, but you don't really get that emotional connection to the characters. I think that's, if there's one criticism of Nolan's films, it is this kind of Stanley Kubrickian style, almost like he's a chess master controlling the board, and you never quite get involved in the characters from an emotional point of view. You do with the Elizabeth Debicki character because of her wanting to see her son, and Branagh is trying to keep her from seeing her son. But overall, I thought it was kind of an emotionless film. It's technically wonderful, needs to be on the big screen. I'm not saying people should not go see it, but I was slightly disappointed, I have to say.
Well, I read another review that called it a Bond film on acid, and I'm sure you're aware that one of the critiques of the Bond films is that there's a stunning lack of diversity in who gets to play James Bond. And so are we looking at an alternative to James Bond if you're looking for a Bond that isn't just a white guy?
Yeah, so I like that. And of course, Bond is white and male in the books, so that's why he has been that way. But certainly there could be some variances of that in the future. But John David Washington, I think that was good casting. I think it's good casting to have a black CIA agent. Pattinson fits more the Bond guy. He's very good with the one-liners and things like that. Yeah, I think that was good casting by Nolan, maybe a little ahead of his time, going with a black secret agent. We don't see that a lot. There was a lot of rumors about Idris Elba, who's probably aged out of the Bond role now because it's taken so long to get the Daniel Craig fifth film going. But yeah, I like the casting of John David Washington.
Well, the director, of course, has been nominated for some Academy Awards. Can you name all of them?
So I believe he was up for the screenplay award for Memento back in 2001, the producing nomination for Inception in 2010.
That was original screenplay and best picture.
Yeah, so picture would be the producing.
Oh, gotcha.
I forgot about screenplay.
Oh, yeah.
And then for Dunkirk, directing and producing.
Yes, Best Picture, Best Director for Dunkirk. There you
not,
go.
He has not won an Oscar yet.
Well, that kind of knowledge, that commitment, that is the kind of storytelling and intriguing information that you tune to Prairie Public for. And we are in our fall member drive. And Matt, you know, we've had a couple segments on with you lately with our own Scott Prebis. And I love the feedback that we have been getting from our audience to just have two people who are almost insane in their level of knowledge. What you know about the film industry and what he knows about the music industry and coming together. We love to have experts and people who are passionate on, and you are supporting that when you give us a call at 800-359-4145, 1-800-359-4145. Your sustaining donation in any amount makes everything that you hear on Main Street possible.
Yeah, so those were great segments to do with Scott, and of course, Hans Zimmer came up in the discussion. And we have some very good premiums here, Ashley. If you pledge at $7.50 a month or $90 per year, you get Hans Zimmer, The Classics on CD. And he's a great film composer. If you want a New York Times or Washington Post subscription, The Times is $20 a month or $240 per year. That's the rate for that. The Washington Post, $15 a month or $180 a year. If you want to get The Washington Post and The New York Times, those are great things to have. And those are great premiums. And yes, stay informed with The Times and The Post. And enjoy Hans Zimmer, The Classics on CD. And I hope Scott and I can do some more of those shows. You know, maybe when the Oscars come out and we have some song nominations or score nominations, we can rifle through those. But I think that gives people a sense of the diversity and,
yes.
and the things we do here on the radio division of Prairie Public. It's news, it's information, it's you interviewing authors or whoever. And it's Scott and I talking about film composers. So you have a lot of stuff going on. Mike Olson's music show, very different from Scott's show that he does, but there's something for everyone. So call 1-800-359-4145.
Yeah, it's kind of like turning the channel, but you don't have to actually do that work because that array of news that comes at you every day with Morning Edition and All Things Considered, the depth of the reporting alone, regionally, nationally, internationally, and of course, everybody doing the work very differently now as we are in the middle of a global pandemic. And then when you need a break from that, we have a show like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me or Away With Words. Whatever is your reason for supporting Prairie Public, we'd love to hear from you now. When you call 1-800-359-4145 and make your donation, then let us know why you support this station. You can also go online to prairiepublic.org. Dakota Datebook is next.
If you measure a year in breaking news events, you're probably thinking it's something like 2025 by now. Public Radio helps you keep up with it all. No matter how long this year feels, make today count by donating to this station.
Call 1-800-359-4145 or join us online at prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 11th. Before the 1908 Republican Convention, Teddy Roosevelt announced that he would not seek a third term as president. He gave his support to his Secretary of War, William Howard Taft. Taft was not enthusiastic about politics. He loved the law and would eventually serve as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. His wife teamed with Roosevelt to convince him to run for office. Up until the late 1800s, actively campaigning for the presidency was seen as being power-hungry and overly ambitious. Candidates stayed home and let their supporters do the campaigning. In 1896, William Jennings Bryan, a superb public speaker, took to the campaign trail enthusiastically. He traveled 18,000 miles in 3 months. He was still defeated by William McKinley. On this date in 1908, the Washburn Leader reported on Taft's campaign in Ohio as the candidate made his way west. Taft was running against William Jennings Bryan. Taft declared that if elected, I propose to devote all the ability that is in me to the constructive work of suggesting to Congress the means by which the Roosevelt policies shall be clinched. In those days, the campaign trail meant train travel. Politicians of the day routinely gave long speeches, speaking for hours. The term whistle-stop tour described short stops in small towns. Because some of his court rulings were seen as anti-labor, Taft knew he had to counter that by connecting directly with voters. He would need the support of the common people, like farmers. Taft would speak for a few minutes from the train, and then it was on to the next town. The strategy was brilliant. People felt they got to know him as a real person. While Bryan spoke to huge crowds at his campaign events, Taft talked to small groups of locals who gathered at train stations. He took his campaign to small towns throughout the country. And North Dakotans were enthusiastically behind him. The Grand Forks Herald said, "For the same reasons Theodore Roosevelt is the type of citizen North Dakotans love to honor, William H. Taft is the candidate to whom this state will give a very large majority of votes at the coming election," unquote. And the prediction was correct. He won North Dakota with over 60% of the popular vote on his way to a landslide victory. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Gravely ill with COVID, Myra Ramirez barely survived a double lung transplant. Her agonizing recovery included vivid nightmares.
Most of them involved me drowning, and I attribute that to me not being able to breathe.
That story, plus the makings of a legendary Russian spy ring, and all the news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Well, that is it for our Friday edition of Main Street, and we will be back on Monday with a fascinating discussion about behavioral health and some free online resources that are coming your way thanks to a partnership between UND and Sanford Health to help you cope during these difficult times. And our favorite partnership here is when you become a member and support the service that you rely on for the news day in and day out. It starts with a simple phone call, 800-359-4145, or you can click and join at prairiepublic.org. Go into this weekend knowing that you have taken this off of your task list and that the programming that you have come to rely on will be here for you when you tune in again on Monday, again for that fascinating discussion about behavioral health. 1-800-359-4145 or prairiepublic.org. And we thank you. Enjoy your weekend.